welcome to the Bogosity Podcast for the 14th of October 2013, the podcast that gets pulled over for speed reading. This is your host, Shane Killian. Joining me again this week are Jonathan Loche and Tim Dyson. Guys, welcome back to the show.
Good day, everybody. Pleasure as always.
What else am I going to do?
It's only a Saturday evening. But before we get to the news, I want to talk about a thread I created this past week on the Bogosity.tv forum. And it's from something Jonathan said after we recorded last week's podcast. You remember I mentioned the book Catch-22 in a segment, and I had used a quote from Catch-22 to finish off the podcast. And in the tag, Jonathan quoted a bigger passage of the book. And then after we stopped recording and we were getting all the files together, you had said something, Jonathan, about Catch-22 being much more deserving to be the premier libertarian novel than Atlas Shrugged.
Well, it just, I think, in terms of, you know, what books people reference, usually it's Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, or in something more a nonfiction like The Law by Bastiat or something by Murray Rothbard. I never really see a book like Catch-22. But you read it. I haven't read it since I was a senior in high school. I actually reread it this week. There are very libertarian streaks written throughout that entire novel in terms of the government. I mean, the whole idea of Catch-22 is something that can only exist in the government.
Yeah, I reread it earlier this year, and I hadn't read it since, like, high school or something, and it really got me to appreciate it again. If you like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's that same kind of dry, witty humor. So, it got me thinking, there are a lot of novels with libertarian themes which are not only much better written than Atlas Shrugged, but also don't have all that objectivist baggage coming along with it. So, I'd like to go over the thread that I created and see if we can add some well-deserved books to people's reading list. And I started off with Catch-22. I just want to quote a bit of it. It's not quite as long as what Jonathan quoted at the end of the last podcast, but I love this segment. We're talking about two different things, Yossarian answered with exaggerated weariness. You are talking about winning the war, and I am talking about winning the war and keeping alive. Exactly, Clevenger snapped smugly. And which do you think is more important? To whom? Yossarian shot back. Open your eyes, Clevenger. It doesn't make a damned bit of difference who wins the war to someone who's dead. Clevenger sat for a moment as though he'd been slapped. Congratulations, he exclaimed bitterly, the thinnest milk-white line enclosing his lips tightly in a bloodless squeezing ring. I can't think of another attitude that could be depended on to give greater comfort to the enemy. The enemy, retorted Yossarian with weighted precision, is anybody who's going to get you killed, no matter which side he's on. And don't you forget that, because the longer you remember it, the longer you might live. But Clevenger did forget it, and now he was dead.
Impressive.
Of course, I also had to include The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein, and this novel helped me on my way to becoming a libertarian when I read it as a teenager. Basically, the moon has become a penal colony where all the countries of the world sent their worst criminals, but now a few generations have passed, and the world government still run it like a prison, despite the fact that the only crime these people committed was being born there, so...
I haven't read that one in a while, but that and Starship Troopers, which shares very little with the movie.
Oh, unfortunately, I saw the movie.
Yeah, I think both those are bigger sort of in the sci-fi community than...
Yeah. It's kind of weird because people read Starship Troopers and they think, whoa, I thought he was a libertarian. When did he become a socialist? It's not a handbook, people. He's trying to explain to you how bad things would be if you have a socialist system. So I just want to quote this one part from The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And this one is said by the character Bernardo de la Paz. I will accept any rules that you feel necessary to your freedom. I am free, no matter what rules surround me. If I find them tolerable, I tolerate them. If I find them too obnoxious, I break them. I am free because I know that I alone am morally responsible for everything I do.
Sounds like a cut-dyed-in-the-wool libertarian quote to me.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. I've used that one for years. I also added The Hunger Games Trilogy by Suzanne Collins. I know, they're pop-teen novels. But these books are excellent. They're wonderfully written, and they're just brimming over with libertarian themes. It's this dystopian future where most people live in the districts, and they're all oppressed by the capital, and the capital is where the governing people live, and they live in this lap of luxury while the people in the districts just scrounge for stuff, and so they end up slowly growing their revolution against the capital.
Yeah, I never read the books. From what I saw the movie, the only thing I don't like, the antagonists drag it down. They're not very interesting. They're total cartoon characters to me.
Yeah, they're a bit more interesting in the books.
Yeah, I would have expected. Because I always said, big literary rule, bad guys do not see themselves as bad guys.
Right. My biggest problem with the movie, Woody Harrelson was the wrong choice for Haymitch. I'm sorry, it is not right.
Yeah, that can happen sometimes.
It does have these libertarian themes running through it. It's not very quotable, you know, as far as like what we just heard from Heinlein. But it doesn't really give you the impression of, you know, really how libertarian this idea is. But it's still a good quote. A shiver goes through me when I think of the proximity of my mother and sister to this man who despises me. And she's talking about President Snow, basically the tyrant who's in charge of everything. Will always despise me, because I outsmarted his sadistic Hunger Games, made the Capitol look foolish, and consequently undermined his control. All I was doing was trying to keep myself and PETA alive. Any act of rebellion was purely coincidental. But when the Capitol decrees that only one tribute can live, and you have the audacity to challenge it, I guess that's a rebellion in itself.
It's simple, but it works.
Yeah, like I say, it's more libertarian in what happens than it is in nice little quotes you can pull out.
It's just sort of sneaking there in the background, you know.
Yeah. And of course, there's no way I couldn't include Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Now, this one I actually have read. Except, unfortunately, it was in high school when I really wasn't as smart as I am now and really didn't appreciate the message of it.
It's not really the same when they make you read it.
Yeah, that too. I was reading it, and I thought everyone in here was just insane. Like, I didn't get what they were talking about.
Well, again, the idea is it's not a handbook. It's supposed to show you how insane this whole thing is.
Yeah, I think the comparison to 1984, which we're going to talk about in a second, you know, everyone's like, oh, we're in 1984 now. But I think if you read Brave New World versus 1984, I think the current world we live in, there's a lot of modern-day parallels to Brave New World. I think far more than in 1984, and that's kind of scary. You know, sort of Orwell feared that government would always have to suppress the truth. Huxley figured out that if you can get to a point where no one's going to give a damn what the truth is, and that's where we are, sadly.
Yeah, and that comes out in this quote I've got from it. One would think he was going to have his throat cut, said the controller, as the door closed. Whereas, if he had the smallest sense, he'd understand that his punishment is really a reward. He's being sent to an island. That's to say, he's being sent to a place where he'll meet the most interesting set of men and women to be found anywhere in the world. All the people who, for one reason or another, have got too self-consciously individual to fit into community life. All the people who aren't satisfied with orthodoxy, who've got independent ideas of their own. Everyone, in a word, who's anyone. I almost envy you, Mr. Watson. It's kind of like the thing a lot of atheists say about hell. That's the place to go. All the fun people are there. And so you mentioned 1984. Of course, I had to include that. And I was actually in junior high or high school during 1984. Well, I graduated in 1986. So, yeah, it was high school in 1984. So, of course, not only were we talking about it a lot in school, there was all the stuff talking about TV. Are we in 1984? And it really is, you know, when you think about novels of dystopian futures of oppressive governments, 1984 is usually one of the tops of the list.
Mm-hmm.
I always wondered, you see all these books and movies of oppressive governments, why does it never seem to make people think? Is it just so inconceivable that something like that could happen to them?
I think it's the whole it can't happen here thing.
I'm sure those people in those stories said so once too.
Oh, sure. And in history.
It's tough for people to visualize it because when they don't use the same, you know, when they don't call it the Department of Propaganda or whatever. I forget. What were the names of the agencies in 1984? It's been a while.
Oh, I don't remember any specifically, but they were all made to sound like good and lofty goals. And really, of course, they were usually the opposite of what their name said.
And so we have, you know, TSA, Homeland Security. Just because they aren't using the same name as the novels doesn't mean they're filling the same role.
Remember what you said about Homeland Security, because I'll have something to say about that a few books from now. But go ahead.
I think there's just sort of a natural detachment of like Tim was saying, that it can't happen here. And even though you can see all the parallels, I guess you just, the natural human tendency is, no, we don't want to get like that, so we'll just bury our head in the sand.
It was a demotivational poster that summed it up pretty well. It shows a picture of a bunch of stormtroopers from Star Wars walking down a street. It says, do you really think they're going to be this obvious?
Yeah. I assume a photo from Comic-Con or somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on in the picture, but...
I haven't... even before Disney bought out Star Wars, the Disney Hero Land, they would have the world's largest Star Wars cosplay every year, and they'd have, a parade of 5,000 stormtroopers down Main Street.
Well, maybe that was what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, my quote from 1984 is, "The essential act of war is destruction. Not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces, or pouring into the stratosphere, or sinking in the depths of the sea, materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable, and hence, in the long run, too intelligent." I also included Orwell's novel Animal Farm, which is another good one.
Did read that one. But again, I was a kid and didn't really get it that well.
Well, a lot of people think it's a children's book because it's got talking animals in it, but no, it's not.
That was one of the first ones that made me sort of politically aware because of the great quote towards the end, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Which was the quote I was going to have, you bastard.
Well, that is the one everyone remembers.
It's okay. Well, yeah, and it's been quoted and requoted. It was used in the original Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. I think it was Dr. Zaius who says all apes are created equal, and he says some apes, it seems, are more equal than others. And so that goes back to Animal Farm. And that's what I like about the novel, though. It shows how oppressors can use the language of liberty to oppress the people and make you think that you're getting equality and liberty and independence when really you're just being controlled by the powers that be.
It's funny, when I was reading it, I was practically yelling at the animals, like, come on, this guy, how can you not see this is a total scam? What is wrong with you people?
Yeah.
Kind of a preview of things to come from my debating online.
Yeah. This next one, I'd actually be surprised and impressed if you've read this, but it's The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood.
No, I have not.
I've heard about it, but I've never had a chance to read it.
It's really good, and there was a movie version of it that's really good, too, and it's mostly about the oppression of women, but the same kind of thing. And you remember what you were saying earlier, Jonathan, about Homeland Security?
Mm-hmm.
Homeland is the word they use in The Handmaid's Tale. And that was the first thing I thought of when people said Department of Homeland Security. I'd say, well, there's nothing Orwellian about that. I'm like, read The Handmaid's Tale. So here's my quote from this one. "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs," is what he says. "We thought we could do better." "Better?" I say in a small voice. "How can he think this is better?" "Better never means better for everyone," he says. "It always means worse for some." Now this next one I'm sure more people are familiar with, V for Vendetta by Alan Moore, the great graphic novel. The movie's really good too, but it's got a different vibe than the graphic novel does.
Shane, have you read the graphic novel?
Oh yes, I've got a copy of it.
Because I read the movie, it definitely has a very libertarian bend to it. I don't know, I think it was more of like a syndico anarchist vibe from the graphic novel and sort of, instead of a more strictly libertarian or ANCAP route.
Well, it was definitely more anarchist than the movie was. I mean, he doesn't actually come out and say what he thinks the ideal would be.
I've seen in an interview where he says, anarchy, I believe, is the only moral way to run the world. The idea that everyone should be master of his or her own destiny. He said, the course of history is very clear that 99.99999% of the world's problems are caused by 0.00001% of the world's population. And that tiny percent is leaders. He says, what we need is an administration at most. We don't need people to boss us about. Those were his words.
Sounds kind of libertarian.
So take that as you will.
Well, the speech I love from the graphic novel, I'm not going to read out, but it's that speech in the middle that this kind of mock dialogue he has with Lady Justice. And, of course, Lady Justice is a statue, so talks of, he provides her lines, too. But it's this great speech. I'll let you read it. But the bit I'm going to read out is from the beginning when he's taking over the airwaves and he's talking to people. And if you remember in the movie, he's kind of like being inspiring, you know, rise up with me and take him down. In the graphic novel, he's doing a lot more dressing them down. So here's part of what he says. Let us not mince words. The management is terrible. We've had a string of embezzlers, frauds, liars, and lunatics making a string of catastrophic decisions. This is plain fact. But who elected them? It was you. You who appointed these people. You who gave them the power to make your decisions for you. While I'll admit that anyone can make a mistake once, to go on making the same lethal errors century after century seems to me nothing short of deliberate. You have encouraged these malicious incompetents who have made your working life a shambles. You have accepted without question their senseless orders. You have allowed them to fill your workspace with dangerous and unproven machines. All you had to say was no. You have no spine. You have no pride.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So I posted that with an invitation for people to add more, and a couple people came up and said, well, there are some libertarian video games, and that spawned a different thread. But Niall Kroc came in with a novel called The Probability Brooch by L. Neil Smith. I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with L. Neil Smith. He's not only a science fiction writer, he's also an activist libertarian. He joined the Libertarian Party in like 1972, the year after it formed. And, you know, he's run for various offices in different times. So he's very much a libertarian. Have either of you read it?
Can't say I have, unfortunately.
I have not, sorry.
He's not exactly a popular author, but it's something we'll have to check out. So here's a quote I found from it. People who object to weapons aren't abolishing violence. They're begging for rule by brute force. When the biggest, strongest animals among men were always automatically right. Guns ended that, and social democracy is a hollow farce without an armed populace to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how representative that is, but sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So go and check out these books, and if you use the links in the thread, you might notice they kind of look a little hinky when you hover over them. Don't worry, they'll take you to where you can buy the book or the ebook at Barnes & Noble, and I promise you there's no malware or anything that's going to happen, and you're not going to pay any extra, but those links will make a little bit of that money go towards the website and the podcast. Bogosity.tv and all of its services are hosted at GoDaddy.com. I've been a satisfied GoDaddy customer for over 10 years now. Their prices are great, and their 24/7 support is second to none. So I'm happy to be able to give you this special offer. Just sign up for any new domain, web hosting, email, or many other services, and get 20% off by typing in the code WOWNOBOGON. That's WOWNOBOGON. Because there's nothing bogus about these savings on quality internet service. Get your own .com with a personalized email address or establish your online business in a snap, all for 20% off. And you'll help this podcast too. Just go to GoDaddy.com and use the code WOWNOBOGON. Welcome back to the Bogosity Podcast. And John, you were going to tell us about something called Silk Road?
Oh, dear, yeah. Last week, the government shut down the Silk Road, which was a Tor-protected deep web site. It billed itself as an online free market, which it was. It's just sort of specialized in selling drugs, forged documents, and basically anything else that black market related.
I had heard something about there was a crackdown on things like selling weapons and stuff like that, that they didn't want to do that on Silk Road.
Yeah, but anyway, so yes, the government had been following it from at least since 2012, sending various fake agents in, or undercover agents in to buy drugs, or in two separate incidents, fake pulling off hits for the founder. So, last week, pretty much shut the whole site down, at least since the story broke, at least about a dozen people have been arrested for selling narcotics. And what the real thing is, the two big things is, A, that Bitcoin was the de facto currency that everyone traded in, and the amount of money that was being made.
There was one thing I was reading about. He had like $80 million worth of Bitcoins, and the feds had no clue how they were going to seize it.
Right, yeah.
Was after like seizing something like $200 million from him.
Yeah, because it's protected by a passcode. So his lawyers are arguing that the generic existence of these Bitcoins isn't the question. It's the question of whether giving up this passcode would be a violation of the Fifth Amendment.
I've heard of cases like that where someone has a laptop that's protected by a password and the courts want it, and you know, the people challenge it and say, well, no, because you have to have a warrant to do it, and you have to say specifically what it is you're looking for. Tell me what documents you want off the laptop, and I'll give them to you, but, you know, they're not allowed to go on a fishing expedition. And
right.
I think that's had mixed results in the courts. I don't really know what the precedent is on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. What I find truly interesting is the fact that you have such a large, functioning website that was doing probably billions of dollars during the lifetime of the website, all through Bitcoin, all practically anonymously. Really, this crackdown does nothing. All this has done is a big giant signpost to, you know, the cartels in Juarez and South America and anywhere else. Listen, get somebody who has a halfway decent IT development, and you can set up your own version and get the golden goose going for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting the site to pop right back up with a different Dread Pirate Roberts. I was kind of figuring that's why he chose that name, because that's what happens in the movie.
If Silk Road itself doesn't come back up, there's going to be another one that's going to pop up within the next week or two.
Yeah. They're just playing whack-a-mole.
It's just further A showing what a failure the war on drugs is. And I think personally, like I said, putting the tinfoil cap on, I think the reason that Silk Road was taken down was because what it showed Bitcoin.
I think they want something to point at and say, hey, look at all this illegal activity and all the stuff that's going on. That's what Bitcoin's for. Only criminals use Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking. You just know the spin doctors are going to try to use this to bash Bitcoin, but the truth is, it's just an example of why the war on drugs is a waste of everyone's time and money.
I mean, look at the Pirate Bay. Is there a court in the Western world that hasn't heard it? Some type of case regarding the Pirate Bay at this point over the last 10 years? If the Pirate Bay, supposedly this den of evil and sin, can survive for 10 years versus Silk Road, which was pretty much arm raided after 2 years, which one does the government really care about?
Well, I think it was also Dread Pirate Roberts, whatever his name is, I forget it, was being kind of dumb because, you know, supposedly, allegedly, we don't have proof, there hasn't been a trial, and we don't know if he did this or not, but allegedly he paid a couple of hitmen to go after other users of the site, and these hitmen were really FBI agents. But apparently, he paid them through a wire transfer. Now, if you've got all this Bitcoin, and you're down with the Bitcoin, and you're doing something like that, why on earth would you pay them through a wire transfer? That's just dumb.
Hitmen like getting paid in cash.
I don't know.
The tragic thing is this sort of thing isn't really new. Like, legitimate con artists and stuff like that have always gotten away with things. When even when government tries to crack down on them, they just move somewhere else and keep going. And people all, of course, learn the wrong lesson from it. Oh, we need more government. No. This is a lesson that government can't help you. The first line of defense against that sort of thing has to be you.
I think one of the things, too, that you're looking at Dread Pirate Roberts is, he wanted to show how a viable market without any government regulation, or as he correctly puts it, force and coercion, could work. And to a degree, he accomplished that. So bravo, sir.
He didn't really need to, if you think about it. Like, what is it, like, 1/3 of all transactions are done under the table these days?
I believe it.
Yeah. The whole idea of a free market is not a new thing. People have done this for as long as anyone can remember.
Yep. So, you guys know all about asset forfeiture, right? We've talked about it before on the podcast.
Or as I like to call it, shinies, gimme, gimme, gimme.
That's if they were being honest. So I thought it might be good to look at an actual asset forfeiture case just to see how bizarre the whole concept is. And this particular case is from 1962, so this also shows this is really nothing new. You know, it's gotten a reputation of late because it's really been ramped up because of the war on drugs, but it's an idea that goes way back. And this case itself dealt with a man named Richard L. Graves, who was a Nevada casino owner, and he had a dining room called the Golden Rooster Room, and he actually had a solid gold rooster made to feature prominently in it. But this wasn't a, quote, specific and customary industrial, professional, or artistic use, so the director of the mint said he couldn't do it. The government acknowledged that it was an art piece, but it wasn't a customary use like jewelry, so, because this was between 1933, when FDR made most private ownership of gold, except for certain stuff like jewelry, illegal, and 1971 when Nixon ended all that and took the dollar off the gold standard entirely. So they went to court, blah-bitty-blah-bitty-blah, Graves won, the government tried to get the decision reversed. They lost, and the court didn't even grant their request for a new trial, so he gets to keep his art piece and everybody's happy. Well, here's the kicker. The title of the case is, I kid you not, United States versus one solid gold object in form of a rooster.
Now, that sounds like an interesting fight. I got to see this one.
Yeah, my money's on the rooster myself. But that's how asset forfeiture works. They didn't bring the case against Graves. They brought it against the rooster itself.
How do you get that to testify?
Well, you have to make it swear on the Bible first, and that's going to be... But, I mean, that's how it works. They don't arrest you. They don't charge you with a crime. They just take your car or your house or your solid gold rooster, and they press charges against that and say that was used in a crime, so that's what we're going to take.
So we need these guys to protect us from theft, right?
Right, yeah. And here are some other forfeiture cases since then. One 1958 Plymouth sedan versus Pennsylvania. United States versus $124,700. United States versus 50 acres of land. United States versus 37 photographs. United States versus 12 200-foot reels of film. And my personal favorite, United States versus approximately 64,695 pounds of shark fins.
This sounds like some kind of bad horror movie where objects have been brought back to life and are waging war against us.
But you even have cases going back as far as 1828 with United States versus 422 casks of wine.
What's that, some kind of drinking contest?
I don't know. They just invented quarters, and they're coming up with a game. But the legal term here is in rem, which means against the thing, as opposed to in personam, or against the person. So the defendant is one or more inanimate objects, which can be seized without just compensation to the owner, you know, completely violating the Fifth Amendment, or the owner being convicted of or even charged with a crime. Also, the standards of evidence are greatly reduced. You have a lot of conflicts of interest since, as we've talked about before, governments and police departments are using this to raise funds. And it's even a case of reverse onus, which is a shifting of the burden of proof. The owner of the property becomes a claimant, and so the onus becomes on him to prove that the object is innocent and he should be given it back.
Now, hold on a sec. This just brings up something. People tell me we can't have free market police or something like that because they're profit-driven and that's bad.
Yeah.
How is this not profit-driven and very much bad?
It's one more thing. The things they're afraid that will happen with the free market are already happening with government.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So what exactly did you solve by having a government here, folks?
Okay, here's the interesting thing about the government shutdown. They don't have money to keep open parks that they don't even pay for, but they're still shilling in Congress for a war in Syria. Has anyone else noticed that?
Oh, of course.
Well, you know, because Assad is this horrible tyrant who murders civilians, and the rebels are all good and decent freedom fighters who need our help, right?
Where have we heard this before? I have this horrible deja vu feeling.
Well, according to Human Rights Watch, rebel forces in Syria killed 190 civilians and took over 200 hostage during an offensive in August, and they say their findings strongly suggest crimes against humanity were committed. And so these are the people we're going to side with.
And all this talk about chemical weapons and everything, U.S., I got two words for you. Agent Orange. Sound familiar?
Yeah. Or Waco, Texas.
It's always the same old story. Whenever it comes time to pay the people whatever they're supposed to serve, all of a sudden it's cutbacks and queues. But whenever they want to do their own thing, all of a sudden there's plenty of money to go around.
Yeah. And of course, it's the same story we've always seen about war, you know, trying to go in on the side of good to topple the evil dictator. Well, not all fights are good versus evil. Some are just evil versus evil.
And the worst thing is, you're probably just making it worse by adding fuel to the fire. If you just let them alone, eventually, they're going to run out of funds and say, okay, this is stupid, let's just go home and forget about it.
Yeah.
But not if you keep funding it like this.
History is written by the winners, and so apparently is economics. That's why there's Liberty Classroom. Probably the best single learning resource for history and economics on the web, Liberty Classroom teaches U.S. history, Western Civ, and economics from actual university professors.
There's lots of free material to get you started, including introductory lectures on all these subjects. And when you sign up, you'll get the full site's content for just $99 a year, less than the price of 2 cups of coffee a month. And if you type in the promo code Bogosity in all caps, you'll get your first year for just $88. Lectures are available in both video and audio format, so you can watch or listen to them on your computer, your phone or tablet, or in your car. Learn at your own pace about the subjects you're interested in and become a more effective debater. You'll also get access to lots of supplemental materials and even the professors themselves via the discussion forum and even live video chats. Inform yourself against the myths and propaganda of our society. Visit LibertyClassroom.com. Welcome back to the Bogosity Podcast, and Tim, this next one I've had on the list for a couple of weeks, ever since you pointed me to the province, and how for some reason Canada's wonderful healthcare system has stopped two dads from becoming legal parents. What's that all about?
Oh yes, I have, I read stories like this in the paper all the time, people tell me they don't happen. Yeah, I live in Canada, I read the paper here, okay, so, this is silly. But anyway, the story went something like this. It was two dads by the name of Richard Abgrall and Anthony Marinert. I'm pretty sure I've butchered those names horribly. I do apologize, gentlemen.
It might be Marinert or something if they're French-Canadian.
Could be. They had a child by way of a surrogate mother, and the child needed a hernia operation when he was born. Unfortunately, they had to wait 4 months for this because they weren't legal parents. Because the surrogate's name automatically went on the birth certificate, and they had to climb Mount Bureaucracy in order to get that cleared up.
Wow. And 4 months is a big deal when you're talking about an infant.
Yeah, indeed. And thankfully, the kid had the operation. He's okay now. But if this was something life-threatening, this could have turned very tragic and completely pointlessly.
And that hernia, I imagine the kid was suffering pretty good. Hernias do not feel good.
I've heard all the horror stories about them.
He got the operation when they got a temporary health card, and then I think it took them years to actually become the official parents.
Yeah, we may have legalized gay marriage, but we still managed to find ways to muck things up for them.
But that's what happens when you put it in the hands of the government, because government gets to say, you know, you get to make healthcare decisions for this other person, and then something like this happens, and, I mean, they can come in and do whatever they want. It's not the abuse of power, it's the power to abuse.
Yeah, if this was a free market healthcare, they could just take the child into the doctor, arrange an appointment, and there you go. When I went for LASIK surgery, because it's cosmetic, it's not covered by our system, I went in, discussed the details, I had an appointment set up in 3 weeks or so.
Yeah. Actually, they have a system like that in Canada, where you can get treatment the same day, including MRIs. Surgeries are quick and cheap, and even medicine's a lot cheaper. The only problem is, in order to take advantage of it, you have to walk on four legs and meow or bark. Because it's the veterinary system.
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous. What exactly are we accomplishing by adding all these middlemen to healthcare? I mean, of all the things in the world to monopolize, healthcare is probably the second dumbest, for number one being justice, in my opinion.
The thing that always gets me is, it's pretty much always advocated by people who say we can't have a free market because monopolies are bad. Wait a minute.
And the thing people don't realize, healthcare is not actually as expensive as it's made out to be. The reason why for all these expenses, politicians, all the middlemen, all the alphabet soup of departments who just keep on growing, that's got to come out of somewhere. Where do you think it's paying for? When you pay $10,000 for surgery, it's like you're actually paying $1,000 for the surgery and $9,000 for all the bureaucracy that went into it.
Yeah, and doctors have to spend 5 hours of an 8-hour day filling out paperwork, and insurance companies are forced to cover like chiropractic and acupuncture and ingrown toenails or whatever. And of course, that just raises up the costs.
The local hospital by me, it's one of those, you know, big multi-story, big 20-plus story buildings each. The billing unit is 3 times the size of the surgery unit.
Wow.
I don't even want to know what it's like at our hospital where I live.
Well, that's Florida. They're a really bad state for that kind of thing.
It's an interesting story the free market taught about this. Even if you didn't have all the bureaucratic overhead, there's still an inherent problem with saying we got to have some healthcare system. Company that makes Prego pasta sauce. they hired this guy who had worked with Pepsi before. They wanted him to come up with the perfect pasta sauce, which would allow them to beat Ragu, who was currently killing them in sales. And he disagreed. His philosophy was, there is no perfect pasta sauce, there is only perfect pasta sauces. You're never going to have one system that serves everyone's needs. And so this is the inherent problem. Even if you had a government system that wasn't all laden down, you still have a system that's forced on everyone, and there's going to be some people that it just simply does not work for. No matter what, you've got people who are forced to pay for a system that is not serving their needs, and there's no argument to be made for that.
Yeah, Pepsi didn't get to be dominant by trying to be as close to Coke as they could. You know, they made a dark fizzy soda, but in their own way, I think it's less sweet than Coke and has a more citrusy flavor, things like that. And you can't become dominant by doing exactly what someone else is doing. As my friend Lee Wright says, if you want to make a difference, you have to be different.
And what did Prego learn from that? They made a variety of different pasta sauces, and what did they have to show for it? Several million dollars in the bank, and finally beat the Ragu.
Nice story. Well, now something from my neck of the woods. The Department of Justice is suing the state of North Carolina over our hideous new voter ID law, and voter advocates have been calling this the most restrictive voting requirement since the Civil Rights era. Now, the idea behind this law is to stop voter fraud by making people show a state-issued photo ID when they go and vote. The problem is this kind of fraud is very rare. You know, they've only been able to come up with a couple of cases of it actually happening and not in every election. It's much more likely that a voter without an ID is a disaffected person, you know, like an unemployed person, particularly minorities. They might have a birth certificate. They might have social security card, all sorts of things they can use to prove their identity, but they don't drive. They don't have driver's license. They don't have a passport or anything like that.
And I'm guessing it probably wouldn't be that difficult to have voter fraud anyway with a fake ID or something if you really wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to solve a problem. The people who are going to engage in voter fraud are just going to get a little more clever about it, and everyone else is still going to be disenfranchised.
Let's find an election where dead people don't vote.
Yeah. I want more chances to vote for dead candidates. Let's have a dead president, see how well that works out. Can't be any worse.
Vast improvement. His only purpose is taking up the position so nobody else can have it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, this law also eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds who will turn 18 by the next election, which kind of goes along with something else they did, which isn't a big deal in and of itself and is something you could debate, like eliminating same-day registration. But what if someone turns 18, you know, the day before or the day of the election? There would be no way they could register and vote in an election that they should be legally allowed to vote in, and the Constitution says you have to allow them to vote.
I think really all this voter ID stuff, I chalk this in with things like abortion. It's such a minutiae issue in the everyday thing, but it's easy to get people pissed off when you talk about it. It's just sort of one of those little tricks of, here, look at the shiny thing on this side where, as all the more important issues pass you by.
Now, to be fair, there are some good things in this bill. There's an earlier primary date. They made it easier for candidates to file for office. And the thing I love about it is the elimination of straight party voting. And none of those things are things that Holder is going against, so those will stand. But I can't help coming back to the thought that if North Carolina were really concerned about doing the right thing for the voters, they get rid of their hideous ballot access requirements that are the second most onerous in the country, or even to start counting our constitutionally valid write-in votes.
Or even you saw with Gary Johnson, where several states, particularly ones that had a lot of Republicans in them, pretty much tried every trick in the book to make sure he didn't appear on the ballot.
Yeah, the thing is, the people in charge should not be in charge of who gets to run. I mean, that is just a clear conflict of interest, as we saw with Ron Paul's last attempt to get in. Oh, wait, we're going to raise the ceiling so you can't get in the debates, even though you totally qualified for them. Tough luck.
But, I mean, I think it does go to show us what Republicans mean when they say they're in favor of limited government. They mean government limited to them and their cronies.
Not that the Democrats are any different.
No. You say you don't like Bitcoin? Why not? Oh, because it's not gold. No problem.
just go to coins.bogosity.tv and you'll be taken to Coinable, where you can buy gold or silver coins or bars with your bitcoins, with literally up-to-the-minute spot pricing. Now there's no reason not to jump on the Bitcoin bandwagon. Whether you're a Bitcoin miner, service operator, Bitcoin business owner, or market speculator, you can get gold and silver from reputable dealers. And Coinable has Bitcoin liquidity for fast processing of your order. Coinable even utilizes a special shipping infrastructure to ensure that your investment arrives safely at your door. And you know what? By going to coins.bogosity.tv, you won't pay a penny more, excuse me, a Satoshi more for your purchase. But you'll help this podcast. You can even sell your gold and silver for Bitcoin as well. Coinable is your Bitcoin to gold marketplace. So go to coins.bogosity.tv and start turning your Bitcoins into gold now. Welcome back to the Bogosity Podcast. We are Shane, Tim, and John, and we're about to sling brickbats at this week's biggest bogun emitter. And I know I said I wouldn't do cops behaving badly stories unless they're an extreme case, but if this isn't an extreme case, I don't know what is. So this is an undercover cop whose name wasn't released, but he was posing as a student under the name of Daniel Briggs. The thing is, he did such a terrible job that other students started calling him Deputy Dan. He was that obvious. But there was one student, the 17-year-old son of Doug and Catherine Snodgrass, who was autistic, and autistics aren't very good at reading social cues, so it's a lot easier to snow them about things like that. He also suffers from Tourette's syndrome and bipolar disorder, and so he had a lot of trouble making friends at school, but Deputy Dan quickly became his best friend. His parents were pleased. Finally, their son had a real friend, and it was exciting. He was talking about his friend and how good it was. But, of course, every time they said their son should ask Dan over, Dan always had some kind of an excuse. So he started putting pressure on the boy to get drugs for him, including sending him over 60 text messages. Now, it's really, autistics get under a lot of pressure. I mean, psychologically, when you do something like that, and you add in the bipolar disorder, I imagine, you know, this wasn't easy on him. It got to the point where he was actually engaging in self-harm. And finally, just to kind of make life a little better for himself, he gave in and bought a small amount of pot for his good friend Dan. Dan pressured him again, and he did it a second time. But after that, he refused to do it anymore. And that was when Dan arrested him and got him expelled from school.
Wow, what's the matter? You ran out of minorities of target?
The depressing thing is this was part of an official operation called Operation Glass House. And this is where undercover operators went into three high schools posing as students. All total, 22 students were arrested on drug charges, and the majority of them were special needs students.
All right, now let's think about the consequences of this. Now these kids have a criminal record. That's a checkbox. They got a tick on every job application for the rest of their lives.
Well, they're juvenile, so I think that's sealed. I don't think it works that way when if you're under 18.
Well, it may not, but whatever the case, it could make it harder for them to get employment, which would make the drug trade a lot more alluring. They create monsters, and then they tell us we need them to protect us from monsters.
I actually have two people who, while I was in high school, who got busted for pot, and yeah, one guy, they just sort of made him pay like a couple $100 fine. He had to go to a couple like touchy-feely classes where he had like, oh, drugs are evil, drugs are bad, and then the moment you walk out, everyone's lighting up a joint. The other guy I know, I don't think he ever got convicted, but he was facing some criminal charges that he was charged as an adult for, so just because you're 18 doesn't mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, Deputy Dan, I hope you're proud of yourself. You took advantage of and psychologically abused an autistic and bipolar teenager just so you could get someone arrested on a drug charge, recorded with your high and worthy deeds. I assure you, you will be forever commemorated as this week's biggest bogun emitter. Okay, guys, I'm too depressed now. I want to talk about something fun before we finish this up. You guys heard about the cache of Doctor Who episodes that were found in Nigeria?
I did, actually, yes.
You had all the rumors leading up to it that they had found like 100 episodes or something like that. It wasn't that much, but it was. They were both Patrick Troughton episodes, The Enemy of the World, which is complete, and The Web of Fear, which they found all but part 3. And I don't remember where there was a find that big.
Yeah. Web of Fear was interesting, because I was kind of wondering why they brought back the Great Intelligence, because I think both, prior to this, both of his previous stories were lost, weren't they?
The Web of Fear is the second great intelligence story. I think The Abominable Snowman is the first. Although a lot of fans like me have a theory that Fenric was the great intelligence.
Either way, I think that... I was sort of wondering why they... I guess I don't know if this was planned or just the fun coincidence, but especially the fact that you have two nearly complete Second Doctor stories, because so much of his era is lost. I think it's just a great thing for sci-fi fans everywhere that these can finally see the light of day again.
Mm-hmm. And it's also good timing with the 50th anniversary coming right up. Probably a good way to promote it since the BBC aren't. Well, I mean, what? We got a little over a month ago, and where are the trailers? Where's all the hype about it?
That's kind of like I'm kind of depressed because the way Stephen Moffat was talking, they sliced up a lot of Matt Smith's era. The way he was making you think it was that, we only got, there was only, what, four or five episodes in 2012 versus the normal 13. And the way he was talking, like, oh, yeah, we're going to do that so we can have, a big super 20-plus episode season plus specials for the 50th anniversary year. And we got, what, 8, 9 episodes plus 2 specials?
Well, there's also that documentary special Mark Gatiss is doing. I forget what it's called. An Adventure in Time and Space or something like that.
Yeah, but still. Like I said, Doctor Who is easily the best thing government-run television has ever given us.
Yeah.
But it's still made by government-run television.
And it shows a lot of times. Well, we do have some excitement with Peter Capaldi taking over the role. And he played a Malcolm Tucker in The Thick of It. And he was also Caecilius in the Doctor Who episode Fires of Pompeii, as well as Frobisher in Torchwood Children of Earth, the Doctor Who spinoff.
Yeah.
There was actually a little bit in the editorial section of the paper I saw concerning Doctor Who. I have never watched the show, so I know pretty much nothing about it except the name.
Oh, man, you gotta start watching it. It's awesome.
I don't know. Anyways, it talked about the possibility of a female Doctor Who. I have no idea if that was being talked about or just someone suggested it, but I don't know.
It always comes up whenever there's a new changeover. No, but the thing I keep thinking is, because Malcolm Tucker swore a lot, and so now that Peter Capaldi's playing the Doctor, it's like, but children watch this show, can he keep his foul mouth in check? Like, people, he is an actor. The reason why he swore a lot as Malcolm Tucker is because that was in the script. The only thing that has to happen for him not to swear as the Doctor is for Stephen Moffat not to put swear words into the script, and he's not going to. But I mean, it's just like, what are people thinking?
I still all the time people think James Rolfe does that in real life. He's the guy who's the angry video game nerd. He curses a lot in his things, but he doesn't do that in real life.
Yeah.
Silly. He's made it very clear that's just a persona. He's acting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, certainly, because he wasn't amongst the guys that were being rumored for it, so...
Yeah. He's 55, which is the same age William Hartnell was when he started playing the role.
Yeah.
Well, what I think is interesting, though, is, pretty much all the fan theories were wrong, and they were all picking, like, younger actors and stuff like that. But Peter Capaldi was the one that the bookies gave the best odds to. The people who were actually betting on it and putting their own money on it. Go prediction markets.
Well, putting your own money on it, you get better odds.
Yeah, that's that wisdom of crowds. Well, okay, now I'm recharged and ready to take on this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire.
And this time, we're siding with the cop. A police officer with the Coolidge Police Department in Mesa, Arizona, Scott Urkoff, drives his daughter to elementary school, and of course he does so in uniform, but apparently the principal didn't like the fact that he was wearing a gun. He was told he'd have to drop her off and pick her up out of uniform and unarmed.
Well, I will say the police probably should have seen this one coming.
Yeah.
I really just... What can you really say? I mean, so what first we're screaming for cops to be by schools in case some crazy person comes and shoots up the school. Cop drops their kid off every day in uniform. Oh, no, that's going to scare the children.
Well, here's what Urkoff posted to his Facebook page, quote, "Nothing like your kid's school calling and asking if I could not come to pick up my daughter in uniform because parents were concerned when their kids came home telling them there was a man at school with a gun. Are you freaking kidding me?"
I mean, school district, I mean, I know the police have done a lot of dumb things over the years, but you don't combat dumb by being dumber.
Yeah. Well, the thing that gets me is, once again, no one can seem to point to these concerned parents, because all the parents who are speaking out are like, let him, it's just, he's a cop, let him come, you know, in uniform. So, and we see that a lot with schools. Officials do what they want, and then claim it was because of complaints from parents, so that's nice little, you know, passing the buck there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Show me an actual parent who will say that on camera, and then I'll believe it. Until then.
Yeah. So now the school officials have done an about-face, and pretty much as damage control, they want Urquhart to come to the school in uniform and give a talk about all the wonderful things that police officers do for the community. I'm kind of guessing that won't include things like asset forfeiture or arresting people with video cameras or killing family dogs.
Oh, man. If I was really feeling evil one day, I'd go to some kids ahead of time, give them a slip of paper with this question, say, I want you to ask him this question and just tell me what he does.
And what will the question be?
What is asset forfeiture? You know, ask totally innocently.
Yeah, put him on the spot.
Yeah, make him go, how the hell did they know about this?
Well, and I mean, the thing is, if the parents had the option of pulling their kids and sending them somewhere else, then, you know, they could go with whichever school has a policy that makes the most sense. But like they said on South Park a couple of weeks ago, you know, they were complaining to the cable company and they say, well, perhaps you should switch to another cable company. Oh, wait, there's not another cable company, is there? We're the only one in town, while the cable guy rubbed his nipples.
I never understand that. If it's bad to monopolize cable, why is it not more bad to have monopolized something as important as education? Why is it the most important things that people insist must be monopolized, and yet they agree that monopolies are bad?
I don't get it. All of that makes the school officials at Ents Elementary School this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire!
Well, that wraps up this Don't Hate Me Because I'm Beautiful edition of the Bogosity Podcast. Please visit the forums at Bogosity.tv, where you can read the show notes and join the discussion on these and other subjects. This podcast is free but not free to produce, so please donate via PayPal or Bitcoin at the top of the Bogosity.tv website or down the right-hand side of the podcast page, and give generously to keep this podcast going. And if you'd like to contribute to the podcast, just send a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. Put it in an audio file, and if it's good enough, it'll get played right in the podcast. Thank you for listening, and thanks once more to my co-hosts, Tim Dyson and Jonathan Lochey.
Till next time.
Great to be here, and see you next week.
Well, next week I'll be at the Nullify Now conference in Raleigh, so there'll be no podcast for 2 weeks. But until then, here's a quote from John Holt. Let all people come in and vote fairly. It is to support one or the other party to deny any man's vote. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Imported License.
Bogosity.
Christmas time is coming, and the most classic of Christmas stories is A Christmas Carol. But how much do you know about the original Charles Dickens novella? Have you dismissed it as a children's book with one-dimensional characters amounting to nothing but platitudes and cliches? Maybe your appreciation of the book was even muted by those dry, boring, annotated books they made you read in school. My book, the sarcastically annotated A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, uses both facts and humor to present the book in a way you probably haven't seen it before. Giving praise when deserved and beratement when warranted, this book is put in the perspective of its time and shows a dimensional, multi-layered Ebenezer Scrooge from start to finish. Skepticism, history, and even economics are employed to show the book in relation to today in an easily accessible format. Appreciate the Christmas of your youth all over again. Get The Sarcastically Annotated A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, available at Amazon and on PDF as well. And just as a historical note, this week's quote comes from the Chief Justice in Ashby v. White, a 1703 UK case where one Mr. Ashby was prevented from voting by a constable who claimed he wasn't a settled inhabitant, but it was a complete ruse, you know, just a pretense to do that, and that's very close to what the North Carolina law allowed, so I thought that was appropriate. And here's a quote from the ruling. A right that a man has to give his vote at the election of a person to represent him in Parliament, there to concur to the making of laws, which are to bind his liberty and property, is a most transcendent thing, and of a high nature, and the law takes notice of it as such in divers statutes. The right of voting at the election of burgesses is a thing of the highest importance, and so great a privilege, that it is a great injury to deprive the plaintiff of it.